This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Dashran Johan. The Sabah state elections took place last Saturday, and what an absolutely heart-pounding affair it turned out to be. Gabungan Rakyat Sabah, GRS, the coalition comprising of UMNO, Bersatu, STAR, PBS, and a couple of other smaller parties won 38 out of 73 seats, which is one seat more than required to form a simple majority government. Warisan Plus, which comprises of APCO, PKR, AMANA, and DAP, won 32 seats, while 3 seats were won by independent candidates. Alas, the event did not end there. What transpired after was convoluted elite political drama. I mean, it is the new normal of Malaysian politics after all. And this drama left many people annoyed, some people intrigued, and most of us scratching our heads in confusion. So what I'm going to be doing today is take a deep dive into the Sabah state elections results and aftermath, and also its implications on our national political scene. But as always, I can't do this alone. So joining me on the show is a political analyst that I always turn to whenever I'm feeling confused, Dr. Bridget Welch, who's an honorary research associate at the University of Nottingham Asia Research Institute and a frequent commentator on Malaysian politics. Welcome to the show, Bridget. How are you doing?
Thanks very much for having me. It's wonderful to be speaking with you. I'm at home now, back in Kuala Lumpur, in self-quarantine. I'm fine.
Let's get right into it. So let's rewind the clock a little bit. Heading into the Sabah state elections, many analysts said that while it will be too close a contest to call, quite a number did predict that Warisan Plus might just be able to nick it. But, you know, as we know now, this did not happen. So before we scrutinize the details, tell me, as an overall, what does Gabungan Rakyat Sabah's win tell us?
Well, I think, you know, what we're seeing is a situation of coalition government. We're seeing a fragmented political system. You know, from the onset, I never believed that that it was going to be a win, easy win for Warisan. They didn't win before. And what we see in this context is that when you have traditional campaigns that rely on resources and machinery, that this gives advantages to those that have those greater resources. And there were two resources that were being played here. One is the use of federal resources, which many of the GRS parties had, and also the resources of the ground machinery, stronger political parties, of which many of the GRS parties had stronger machinery, particularly UMNO, but not exclusively, also PBS. And, of course, even in the key areas where STAR won, they had better machinery than many of the other parties that were contesting under Warisan Plus. And so what we see is a situation where I think in some ways as the campaign evolved, there sort of became a momentum to say, you know, Warisan is winning, and others, people kept calling me up and saying, you know, is Warisan going to win? And I says, no, it's not clear that it's going to win at all.
You see, you say that, but there were some political analysts who, you know, confidently said 40 to 50 seats, Warisan Plus.
I always believed that they were living in a dream world. But I also think that we are in a situation where I think part of it has to do with the way that the media portrayed the campaign. And I think, and what people saw in the campaign, they saw these images of unity. They saw these liberal ideals that they felt comfortable with. And as a consequence, that this sort of lulled them into a false sense of security. We saw the sense that Shafi was made up into this savior, kind of representing the hopes of reform. And while he, you know, these issues were and still are important for both the Sabah and Malaysia, I think the fact of the matter is that there were other issues that did not get as much attention that were very important for ordinary voters. And I think that the portrayal of the campaign helped to build up the overconfidence of those supporting Warisan Plus, and I think that was a mistake.
Let's talk a little bit about the messaging of each coalition, right? So correct me if I'm wrong, but Warisan Plus's messaging heading into the elections was a lot of it had to do with unity and, you know, autonomy of Sabah, you know, Sabah for Sabahans, whereas Gabungan Rakyat Sabah banked on Muhyiddin as their poster boy, as well as anti-pendatang tanpa izin sentiments, which is the PTI sentiments. So did GRS's messaging resonate with Sabahans more, or is it just to do with money and machinery?
Well, I think you always have to understand, Sabah, like Malaysia, is a very different place. And its different messages resonated with different groups of people in the urban areas versus the rural areas, between educated voters and non-educated voters. And we can see that, you know, there are things that connected to certain groups. Unity, for example, was very powerful among Chinese urban voters. This is why we see 94% of them voted for Warisan, although many didn't come back, many of which, by the way, were located outstation. But also even those that were resistant to voting for Warisan for reasons such as economic performance of Warisan government, what they would do is they stayed home as opposed to voting against it. Right? We see, for example, the autonomy message was important for many of the Kadazan community, for example. And then many of Warisan Plus did win a number of important KDM seats, such as those in Penampang, such as places like Limbahau, or a seat like Moyok in Penampang. These are traditionally they're comprised predominantly of Kadazans as opposed to Dusun and Muruts, and also that they were predominantly also more educated, more wealthier. So again, these issues did resonate, but they did not necessarily resonate across the different spectrum of different classes and different communities. While the issues of the aid and the COVID aid was extremely important among a large number of voters, and I heard this over and over when voters spoke to me about especially among women voters, they said this helped our family, and then they would complain that the Shafi Warisan government did not deliver their 300 ringgit that they promised to deliver. So, and this became a point of contention with them. So therefore, economic issues, which were important for all the voters, but particularly the issues that those that were more vulnerable became more important. And that's where they were capitalized in more of these traditional campaigning. And, you know, and we have to keep on recognizing these differences in the society. I think, in a sense, one of the challenges of this campaign is that, you know, messages that tap into ideals also have to be coupled with messages that speak to concrete issues. If for many, the questions of Warisan was that there were not a sense of how they were going to deliver on these messages in terms of concrete ways. And the Warisan government faced the same government problems that the Pakatan Harapan government faced. A lot of overpromising, not enough economic deliverables, and in some ways, an ineffective communication with what they did in government. They had a very good campaign, but at the same time, they didn't address some of those issues. A good example of that is how they handle the PTI issue. The PTI issue is not their problem. It is the problem of the federal government that originally caused it. But it was perceived as Warisan, as defending the community, the illegal immigrants. And this was not something that was fundamentally addressed. And of course, you know, like Pakatan Harapan had in the peninsula, a problem of dealing with issues of race relations, Warisan had the same problem. And it helps us understand why the KDM, the communities out more broadly, with the exceptions of the seats that I spoke about with more educated voters, did not vote for Warisan Plus. UPCO lost 11 of the 12 seats that it contested in. So what we have to look at is to look at these things holistically. The messaging, you know, was only one part of the campaign, and it resonates with different communities somewhat differently. And also you have to keep in mind that for many people, especially outside, this message of kind of unity and racial unity really was something very powerful for them, and it was a very different narrative than we can even say it was different in some fundamental ways than the Save Malaysia narrative of GD14, in that it was the first time a kind of positive, cohesive sort of identity was being articulated, and that really sort of touched a chord with many people watching the Sabah campaign. But for many people living in Sabah, they see the different differences and different treatments in very different ways. And again, it's to do with the fact that Warisan Plus was the incumbent, and this was a judgment on their governance, not just on their messaging.
Okay, and is Warisan's popularity diminishing? Because there are some who claim that it is, But when we look at the numbers, and the numbers seem to tell a different story, because in G14, Shafi Abdal's party contested for 45 seats and they won 21. And this year, the party contested for 46 seats and won 23. So it doesn't seem like there's a diminished returns in terms of number of seats. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think there are a couple things that are going on here. First of all, one of the things to understand about the voting and how ordinary Sabahans voted is they voted for things that are familiar. And keep in mind that in this type of conditions of economic and political uncertainty, they go with the people they know or the things that they know. So disproportionately that advantaged UMNO, that advantaged parties like PBS, and even to a certain degree STAR, which has been around as a major political force for now over 10 years. And this translated into these different patterns of voting, and it also translated into the results. So I think my sense is that I think that Waterson did not do as well as it did as before. And let me tell you why I count those numbers. Yes, they won the popular vote by a slight majority of 1,900 votes. Okay, less than 1%. All right, but they did not. They have won a lower share of the popular vote in this election than they won in GE14 in 2018. So it went down 3%. And also, when we look at the seat counts, this is an irrelevant count because you have to look at it from the perspective of the fact that there are 13 new seats. And keep in mind that Waterson actually had pushed for 13 more seats. And I believe that this was going to be a risky move from the onset. And in fact, it proved to be risky because Waterson only won 4 out of those 13 seats. So in fact, they may have gotten more seats, but in fact, they did not. They got less share of those seats in the large spectrum. And so what we're looking at is a situation where, we have to kind of dig deeper. And what we see is that the turnout factor really hurt Waterson plus 11% drop in turnout. We also see that they lost support among important groups that are essential. We see, for example, from an ethnic lens that they lost support among the Bajau Sulu community. And it may not seem like a large support, that it's drop of around 5 to 6%. But the fact of the matter is that there was a sense of disappointment. This was the community that was the highest strength support for Waterson. And it made a difference in some of the key races in that context. They lost support particularly from the comments of the military. And if you look at least 3 seats, this military vote made a big difference in the outcome. And so we can see these particular factors that emerge. And what a preliminary sort of exit polling that I did also suggests that they lost support, particularly among female voters, which were very important for Waterson Plus, as well as in the context of many lower class voters, where the aid issue was quite important. And I think that, this was a party that promised to reform and change Sabah. And 2 years on, people said there's nothing they can point to. And that same story is one that Pakatan Harapan faced as a national story. And while I think, Waterson still offered significant alternatives and did extremely well in this election, this is no way they should keep their heads high, given the fact that they faced a massive machine in terms of the way that the federal government and GRS ran its campaign, and it was a well financed machine as well. Money was important, and money did play a role in some of these close races, but it wasn't the only factor, and that's the key thing that people tend to forget. Get from outside, money becomes something symbolic for some others, and sometimes money is taken and not necessarily the voter going in that same direction. And also keep in mind that Waterson Plus parties also played money, so it's not just one side or the other. This was a campaign where money was important across the board, with of course the GRS parties, UMNO, and some of the independent candidates, as well as PN PN having more advantage. And we can look at the seats of where money was a factor and how that disproportionately affected GRS candidates as opposed to Warisan candidates.
Okay. On that same note, I want to also talk about Barisan Nasional and their friends. And when we compare GE14 to today, because of course it was a different scenario back then and there was no Perikatan Nasional. But when we look at Barisan Nasional as a party, Barisan Nasional won 29 seats in 2018. On Saturday, Barisan Nasional won 14. But even if we combine that number with Bersatu, we have 25, which is less than the 2018 one where they won 29. And it's only when we factor in some of the other parties that are in the coalition, such as STAR and PBS, do they make that 38. Does that tell us anything?
Well, it tells us two very important things. The first, that the KDM's parties, which are PBS and STAR, were, in fact, from a perspective of forming the government, kingmakers. I would also argue that there were many kingmakers in this election. The Warisan Plus, for example, would not be, from an ethnic point of view, even in the game, if it wasn't for Chinese support. Mm. They would have lost much worse than they did. But the fact of the matter is, from forming the government, they become the GRS government. The KDM parties of STAR and PBS are critically important. And I think this will be something that will be interesting to watch going forward, is whether or not these parties will become focused on their elite interests and making money, or will they be more focused on actually representing issues of states' rights and trying to address some of the concerns of the KDM community. I think that given the history of PBS and STAR, I think that the sense is that they may, in fact, actually not necessarily be as strong advocates for the KDM down the line. But of course, let's see how things evolve. The second big lesson that emerges is the fact that UMNO is no longer hegemonic. Mm. And this is a national trend. Now, UMNO has been quite adept at adapting to the new environment. Keep in mind that it is the party that helped to form Mafakat Nasional with PAS to strengthen itself to come back politically. It is playing a role in supporting Perikatan Nasional. And of course, it had ultimately in Sabah, it made way at the elite level to facilitate a relatively, I think, less contentious seat negotiations to allow for the seats to work. And while there were some issue early on in the campaign, considerable sabotage, ultimately, UMNO leaders came down to campaign. A good example of that is in the seats like Sungai Manila and Sungai Sibuga and Gumgum, which are seats on the East Coast, which would have been lost, especially Sungai Simula and Sungai Sibuga, if it wasn't for Musa Aman coming down to campaign. And so what we see is a sense that UMNO is adapting to the new environment, but it is also a very different environment, that UMNO is no longer a hegemonic party. And it has to make accommodations. And there are tensions within that party because it's used to being always in charge. And now it has to not to make compromises. And this becomes a difference for that. But those compromises also involve issues of race, issues of religion, the nature of the issues of campaigning. You'll notice, for example, that the Sabah campaign did not have the kind of the toxic kind of racialized Malay campaigning. It was there at the present level, at the quiet level, but it wasn't so open. The issues of religion in terms of religious rights was there, but it wasn't quite as open. And I think what we can see is a shift. GRS, they prevailed, for a number of reasons that were strategic, of which UMNO and other parties in GRS understand. One is that they split the vote in some interesting ways. And they also, they built on the issues of the machinery of resources. UMNO's machinery also helped in other seats that weren't UMNO. UMNO became a team player.
Okay, you bring up a very interesting point about the splitting of votes, which I do want to get into. But for now, we do need to take a quick break. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm Dashran Johan, and I'm joined by Dr. Bridget Welch, who's an honorary research associate at the University of Nottingham, Asia, Research Institute. And what we're doing today is taking a deep dive into the Sabah state elections results, the aftermath, and also its implications on our national politics. So heading into the elections, right, Bridget, many also claim that GRS's lack of cohesion may bite them in the back. After all, there were multiple constituencies where they were battling each other, and many anticipated that this would split the votes, and which would then enable Warisan Plus's candidate in that constituency to pick up the victory. But once again, in many constituencies with multi-cornered fights between their own coalition members, GRS prevailed. Why is this so?
Well, I think that GRS parties, for the most part, they monitor how the process during the campaign very carefully, and they, as a consequence, they adapt in the campaign. And I think they're better at adapting than Pakatan Harapan was more generally in West Malaysia, and they're also better in Sabah than Warisan Plus was. GRS did well, and of the seats that they contested, it was only in one seat where splitting made a difference, in the seat of Manila. And the reason it did well is because of the strengths of the candidates. And in fact, ironically, when they put two candidates against each other, this actually split the vote and in some cases worked in their favor. And the second reason is that the candidates that did contest for many of these areas were really, really quite popular. And you know, this goes back to something I mentioned earlier, the politics of the familiar. People go in a periods of time like this, you know, step away from the Malaysian political scene. Talk about these circumstances. This is a time of significant uncertainty, economic uncertainty, political uncertainty, issues such as COVID-19. People go with the things that they feel the most comfortable with, the comfort, as they might say. And that's why these candidates, the ones that that are known, local deliverables, people you can reach out to, especially in more vulnerable populations, they did well. And many of those were the GRS candidates.
And another thing that I find very fascinating, which I want to dig into, is in constituencies where we did have these multiple cornered fights between team members, for example, UMNO taking on Perikatan Nasional or Bersatu, which proved to be the most popular party?
Well, it depends on the type of seat that it was, right? Okay. So if it was a KDM seat, majority seat, then we would see that the traditional party in that area, such as PBS, would win. Mm-hmm. If it was a seat where UMNO fielded a very strong candidate, then you would see the UMNO winning. So it depended on the type of seat, whether or not it was rural, how rural it was, the type of candidate, and also the ethnic configuration of the seat. So there is no specific pattern. There were these variations. More generally, I would say that PBS did very well in the seats that it traditionally had always won. And UMNO, the same thing. They also won in their traditional seats. STAR has been expanding its political base. And interestingly enough, STAR in some ways has actually had the biggest gain in seats outside of its political base, picking up seats such as that of Pakinatan, which is in the northeast part of the country, and being traditionally that most of its base has been around Tambunan, which is where the kind of the heart of the state rights movement, where PBS was had its core, and then STAR emerged, Jeffrey Kitingan leading that. And in places like Pakinatan, they won because the previous UPCO candidate who had jumped to Bersatu now jumped back to STAR, and STAR co-opted them. And then now they have a base in Pakinatan. So you see a situation where STAR's seats move there. But Abidin won because of resources. This is the candidate of Pakinatan, and also because of his popularity. And also voters in Sabah were quite pragmatic. When in seats that were splitting, they tended to, you could see in the last week of the campaign where the movement went, and they went with those that they thought was going to win. And so, you know, this is the pragmatism of voters cannot be underestimated. And so this is why we see certain people emerging in certain sets of seats when there are split races, especially along those that have had traditional lines.
You mentioned how PBS did very well. And On the other side, on Warisan Plus's side, there is also a quote-unquote KDM-based party, which is APCO. And APCO did not perform well at all. They only won 1 out of 12 seats. So let's talk about Warisan Plus's component parties. DAP performed really well, winning 6 out of 7 seats contested. But PKR, and as mentioned, APCO, not so much. PKR won 2 out of 7 seats. APCO won 1 out of 12 seats. Why did this happen? Was this poor strategy by Warisan Plus, or did people just not believe in these parties, particularly APCO? Did people punish the so-called original frogs that jumped over to Warisan Plus after GE14? Was this a punishment?
So let's take each of these parties individually, because I think it's useful to unpack them, all right? You know, DAP won in the seats that it won before. It won, and these are urban seats, and they won in predominantly Chinese seats and most of the seats that they won. They did not pick up the seat, for example, of Bincor, which is a mixed seat, and they did not contest in that many seats. So therefore, their performance looks great because they didn't really expand. They kept a strategy of consolidation. All right. Now, APCO. APCO, in a sense, ended up contesting in many more seats. And even before the election called, APCO was facing big problems. And they did not, in the seat negotiations, they got many seats of which they would have been unwinnable for anyone in Warisan Plus. And APCO took those seats, such as Bengkoka, for example, and those areas. So they had seats that were very, very challenging. And keep in mind that Warisan, in the seat negotiation, took some of the rural seats that were more favorable to win as opposed to some of the other parties, right? Even for APCO and PKR.
Right.
Now, but that said, there are two legacy issues that APCO faced. The first of which is they had the legacy of being a frogging party. They were the ones, they had emerged in APCO as a party as being in Barça Nacional. If we look at the history of APCO, it was the party that formed and joined Barça Nacional from its roots to defend and to articulate the positions of the KDM community. And in 2018, it left Barça Nacional. And there was a sense of extensive betrayal among its base. So many of its members left, like Abidin, as I just mentioned earlier, and Limas Jury, for example, in the context of Kuala Pinyu, who is now a member of Bersatu in the new government in GRS. So a lot of its members left. And they took with them the machinery, the APCO, on the ground. And then at the same time, the party's leadership did not fundamentally explain to the electorate what were the issues why they moved to join the Warisan government. And at the same time, they had no deliverables to point to for the benefit of having jumped to Warisan. This goes back to the challenge of Warisan's deliverables as in government. So is this APCO's fault or is this Warisan's fault? This becomes a real interesting question in this context. And I think the responsibility should be shared. One is in that it talks about concrete governance, but it's also about communication of a message in this context. And I think that APCO going in social media had the worst reputation. In part, its leader, Marias Tango, who had taken such a strong position against Warisan in the campaign in 2018, many very powerful videos on these positions, as particularly Mahathir. And then he joined and people said, wait a minute, what are you doing here? So there was a legacy that was not adequately addressed, I would say, for many voters. And so it had a reputation problem. Now, PKR, however, has a very different trajectory. PKR, I would say, didn't win their seats. Warisan won the seats for PKR.
What do you mean by that?
What do I mean by that? I mean that it was the Warisan campaign for the Chinese voters in Inanam and Api Api, the two urban seats, and also in Inanam, also many Kerezans, that actually worked in the favor for PKR. PKR did not win them. Warisan's campaign won it for them. And I think in some ways, if you look at the impact of the fact that I would suggest that PKR did not help Warasan in this election. And what do I mean by that? Well, I would say there are a few factors that we have to unpack. The party did not settle its candidates till the last minute, almost looking like it was going rogue. And in a sense, it refused to take on the label of Warasan. And this might have benefited with greater seats, because then they would have had more numbers. Can you imagine if there would have been more numbers under the Warasan logo? Mm. It would have been a very different situation, right? What we see is that PKR wanted to be its own player. And ultimately, I would say, Anwar's announcement really undermined Shafi Abdal's Warasan campaign at a critical stage of the campaign, but taking attention away from the momentum that was being built in Sabah and putting it on himself. And this, for some people, they see this as the competition between Anwar and Shafi, as opposed to, focusing on the issues of Sabah. Why on earth would you be making an announcement during a Sabah campaign about yourself, as opposed to and forming government, as opposed to focusing on the issues of Sabahans?
Especially before even meeting the king and getting some sort of official confirmation on the matter.
Exactly. I think that we're looking at a situation where the dynamics of personality played a role in this context, and it created a sense of confusion. And it on the ground, it really contributed negatively to breaking the momentum of the Shafi campaign at a critical stage. And I think that PKR does have a lot of support among members in the campaign, and many of them worked hard for Warasan. But I think that the party as a whole is quite was not united, and was not seen as as strong a team player. As the other parties. UPCO may have lost a lot of seats in that context, but it still held on to, it still worked, it was seen as being a team player, even though it was in a very difficult situation. PKR, the fact that they had to announce their seats and candidates later is an indication of how the relationship was not working well from the onset.
And I think that's a perfect segue to our next part, where we look at how the Sabah elections could impact our national politics. As we know, there were more plot developments after the election results. There were disagreements between Perikatan Nasional and UMNO on who should be Sabah's chief minister candidate. Of course, they eventually agreed on PN Sajiji Noor, but it looks like UMNO members, particularly President Zahid Hamidi, is very, very unhappy with the proceedings. Could this further strain the relationship between UMNO and Perikatan Nasional if it hasn't already?
So, in your remarks, I want to pick up on the two things that I think are very important, which are the words "looks like."
Mm.
So let me just give you a reminder, is that people should stop taking what politicians say at face value. This is true across the political divide, and we should recognize that comments by politicians are exactly that, comments by politicians that represent party positions and even propaganda in some cases. And I think that in the case of UMNO, UMNO is very very calculating in giving statements that may not in fact actually be what they're feeling, but be about a distraction or be about a political move such as appeasement to the base. It is clear from my understanding is that the deal on Hajiji had been struck before Zahid Hamidi made his remarks. I think these remarks, I interpret them as an appeasement of the base and part of a show, but not necessarily any real substantive differences in that context. Yes, there are some, but whether or not it's at the elite level, and whether or not the sort of accommodation had been made, those issues which were more serious in the early part of the campaign when Muhyiddin and Yassin made those remarks were less as significant than say the drama that played out over the media reporting of what happened afterwards. There were attempts to try to make defections on different sides. That's the nature of politics. And I'd step back from this, and this is where a real challenge that Malaysia faces nationally is that how do you deal with a situation of coalition governments? Because in fact, what what AMNO and GRS were doing, and YRSN was trying, was to form a coalition government. And these are normal processes. What makes this standard uniquely Malaysian is that everything is seen within a polarized framework. You betray this way, you do this to save the country this way, or you do it to save the party that way. And these emotions are real, and I don't want to discount those sensitivities and the substance of where they come from, because they do come from the experience that Malaysians have felt. But at the same time, we're also dealing with a different system of politics, where coalition forming is now a necessary process of building a government. And what GRS was trying to do was trying to build a stable coalition. And what YRSN was trying to do was to trying to prevent that from happening and to build their own.
Okay. And will the situation in Sabah encourage Zahid Hamidi's faction to join Anwar, if that is even a thing?
Well, look, in politics, things are fluid. Mm. And I think that the question is that people will use the issue of defections and in order to articulate as part of their political positioning. Is it true that possibly Zahid Hamidi was using this to push for issues of elections and to strengthen his position at the AMNO? Yes, possible. And indications are that there probably these things were going on. One has to give it a certain degree, in contrast to what I said earlier, a certain degree of some recognition of some of the realities when you see multiple sources of these factors. At the same time, what happens yesterday may not be what happens today or what happens tomorrow in a particular fluid political positioning. Is it clear that these issues of defections and threats to leave are real? Absolutely. And will they continue to be something that plays on the national stage? Absolutely. And it goes back to one of the points I raised earlier. AMNO is already playing this card, and it's playing this card because it believes that if it goes to elections, it will be hegemonic again. It will be able to come back and be in the dominant position. And it does not like being secondary. And this is where Sabah is quite interesting, because it has taken a secondary role, which of course may be indicating that there are these challenges to this hegemonic position. But keep in mind, they have taken the secondary role to Bersatu, which of course is in many ways, for many people, AMNO.
And now I've got a big picture question here, because I'm kind of conflicted right now, because you say that this is the nature of coalition politics, you know, but what does that mean for Reformasi? Because, you know, parties like PH and Warisan Plus, at least on paper, they're supposed to be, you know, the antithesis of these type of politickings, of, you know, party hopping and all these sorts of things. But like you mentioned, these are also the realities, because a few days ago, Anwar did mention that he has enough MPs to form a new government, which whether or not you like Anwar Ibrahim, it also means that there are people hopping over to his side, if what he said was true. And then, you know, there were a lot of rumors and speculations that Shafi Abdal was trying to get MPs over to his side after the election results. And if the parties that their entire campaign was about the anti-Qatar, you know, let's barbecue Qatar, let's bring the frogs down, when these parties are engaging in the very same thing in the name of coalition politics, what do people do?
So there are a few points I'd like to make here. I think, first of all, you know, when we talk about reform in Malaysia, what is important is not just reforming practices, but in reforming the institution and the rule of law and the procedures to basically curb these practices that undermine democratic norms and undermine the issues of bad governance. And this is the real challenge, is that when we look back at Pakatan Harapan, there were very few institutional reforms introduced and many of those that were introduced have now been removed. And I think one of those questions becomes is how do you begin to reprioritize the issues of institutional reforms within these contexts? Right now, the dynamic is such that parties who want to get into government have to join them. to join the practices in order to get into government. And these are, unfortunately, the realities of the way that the electorate is divided and split. And at the same time, every time they compromise, they lose their political base. And what's happened is that there is some of the political base of people who believe in reform and believe in change, leaving the Pakatan Harapan parties behind because of the compromises they are having to make as part of these political practices. These parties are caught within a particular set of spectrum. But it also, I would also say that, you know, the story is not all negative from the Sabah campaign. There are two very important positive things that I think are critical. The first of which is, from a reform perspective, I would argue that the Shafe Abdel Warasan Plus campaign did speak to perhaps most effectively a kind of unity narrative and took on the very sensitive issues of race and religion emphatically in a more inclusive manner. This is the first time we could argue that there has been a campaign of this particular nature, probably since one could argue since the 1950s, when, you know, in terms of talking about bringing Malaysians together as a group, even the Save Malaysia campaign of GE14, which had strong nationalist overtones and talked about people coming together in meaningful ways, didn't necessarily, you know, take on these issues of religion and race the way Shafe Abdel Warasan campaign did. So it is a first step towards normalizing an alternative political narrative than the divide and rule tactics that have been predominant. I think this, it may not, and keep in mind, it won the most popular vote. It may have not won the government, but it won the most popular vote.
Right.
And this is after a government, for many in Sabah, would have said, didn't quite perform as much as they hoped it would. So that also, in a sense, gives a positive story from the perspective of questions of reform. The second issue that I think is happening is that as leaders themselves and their credibility are being challenged, there is a move away from seeing politics as saviors. And this is both positive and negative. It's negative because it facilitates the disappointment that people have, about the Mahathirs, the Anwars, the Shafis.
Perhaps the disillusionment as well.
Yes, exactly. But at the same juncture, it also moves Malaysia towards a recognition that there needs to be new leaders, new ideas, new collaborations, and that in itself can be a positive force. So Sabah fielded a lot of young candidates, not as many young candidates, but fielded some young candidates. The Warasan campaign was quite united. It didn't work as well because it was fragmented, didn't have as many resources and some areas, but there are now, you know, there are different leaders coming to the fore. For whatever we see about Hajiji, we will see how he performs in the context of Sabah. And, you know, things shift in Sabah very quickly, as we've seen in the past. And looking forward, I think Hajiji Noor faces some very serious challenges within the state. Those challenges that are not going away about PTI or poverty or dealing with the federal government and dealing with the ethnic issues that have their own manifestations within Sabah. So when I see this process as a kind of, there have been many positive steps and many negative steps that have taken place. And one cannot see it just about one person losing, because the question becomes what lessons are learned and how people adapt to the new strategies and to the new realities in a different way.
Just one final question, talking about Sabah's immediate neighbor, and that is Sarawak. So heading into the Sabah state elections, there was also a lot of talk that if Warisan Plus wins in Sabah, this could then in turn encourage Sarawak to be, you know, quote unquote, brave themselves and push back against the federal government in the name of autonomy, especially in light of the whole MA63 conundrum. But Warisan Plus did not win. Will this then discourage Sarawak to vote against the federal government if that is indeed what the people of Sarawak want?
The PNBN would not be in power without state-based parties of PBS and STAR. Don't forget that. Number two, star rights, the state rights and state nationalism was a major issue in this campaign. And once you have it out, as we've seen how this movement has grown in Sarawak, it will only expand further in Sabah. And I think it can and will expand further across Borneo. I think few Malaysians genuinely appreciate how strong the secessionist sentiments are within Sabah and Sarawak. The fact is that most people in those states think that they can be better on their own in many ways. And the numbers of this are growing. And I think this is where the federal government and people in Peninsula Malaysia need to be more sensitive to not imposing their type of politics and to address meaningfully some of those issues that are not just in MA63, but some of the issues that the federal government has caused subsequent to 1963 in terms of poverty, infrastructural development, that were not in part of the original agreement, that are meaningful, involving oil and gas resources, involving infrastructure and poverty reduction and amelioration, just to name a few of the many other issues that I think are on the table. And I think what we've seen, in fairness to the Sarawak government, we have seen that they have been quite brave in articulating that. I would say they've been quite strong in articulating state rights issues and pushing for them in the negotiations over oil revenues, for example, the state taxes involving Petronas. And I think that they are, well poised going into the state election for whenever they choose to hold it because of some of those gains. What's interesting to me is to see how forces between Sabah and Sarawak are coming together in very interesting sets of ways. And ultimately, down the line, the issues of state rights and state nationalism are very much on the table, and I think have become stronger out of the Sabah campaign, despite the fact that it looks like that the federal government won.
All right. Unfortunately, Bridget, we are running a little short on time. I mean, I could sit here and talk to you about politics for another 2 hours, but I have to let you go now. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, and I'm sorry if we've spoken too long, and I always look forward to speaking to you again.
I've been speaking to Dr. Bridget Welch, a political commentator and an honorary research associate at the University of Nottingham Asia Research Institute, and she was helping me make sense of the Sabah state election results and also its implication on our national political scene. So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out our podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or even subscribe to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Once again, I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.